If you've bought property, you likely funded your purchase partly through a mortgage. If the property increases in value over time by more than the cost of the borrowing, you're better off. In the stock market, using debt is often called gearing. The new BetaShares Wealth Builder Funds, ASX ticker symbols G200 and GHHF, offer moderate gearing across Australian and global shares for investors who are comfortable with the higher risks associated with gearing their investments. You can discover how they work by visiting betashares.com.au. Please don't forget that gearing magnifies gains and losses, so read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a podcast by the Rask Group. It's for educational purposes only. So please do not make a financial, legal, investment, or taxation decision based on solely what you hear in this show.
Welcome to the Australian Property Podcast.
We're on a mission to be Australia's most trusted property podcast.
I'm Owen Rask, founder of the Rask Group.
I'm Pete Wargent, author and buyer's agent.
I'm Amy Linardi, and I am a buyer's agent.
I'm Chris Bates, ex-financial planner and mortgage broker.
Together, we'll take you through every step of your property journey.
From first home buyer to decades of property investing. G'day, welcome to the Australian Property Podcast, our weekly 2 cent segment with Chris Bates from Flint Group. Hi, Chris. How's things?
Life's good, Pete. It's, I'm just kind of getting over a sickness. I'm a bit scared because the winter and 2 kids at childcare is ahead of me. But I'm just battling on through. I remember people listening to us last year, I was sick for months. And so I'm just a little bit scared that's going to be the case over the next few months. But things have been good in life and outside of work. The kids are crazy. It's how much they're playing together now. My daughter's just turned 4 and my boy's nearly 2.5 now. And yeah, it's a complete different life. They'll play together for hours in the morning and afternoon. It's like, wow, I didn't expect this a few months ago. So that's making things a bit easier in the home. And lots happening on the work front, which we've spoken about on this podcast many times. And what's happening in your world, Pete?
You haven't got time to be crook at the moment. You'll have to shake it off, unfortunately, with all the stuff that's been going on with your new business merger and everything. So, yeah, I guess, similar, really. Our kids are a bit older, so I've had the pleasure of seeing Alice in Wonderland in the Noosa Botanic Gardens this week. And on the work front, well, it's good to see the podcast is growing, over 32,000 unique listeners over the month. So obviously some things, right? I think I was just looking back on what we've done so far. I think the challenge is always to try and pitch this stuff at the right level. And we do a range of stuff from first home buyer episodes, and we do other stuff for people looking to do a property portfolio. I just think everyone's on their own journey with this stuff. Chris, you and I both did a stint overseas before the GFC, and then we started out our own businesses basically just as a one-man band to begin with for both of us. I remember back in the day down in Sydney, and I guess you look back on the journey that we've been on. I was just thinking the other day, my first full-time job when I left school, because I took a gap year, was just a factory labouring job, paying about $7,000 a year. I had a 1983 Ford that was probably worth about $1,000. I don't think I've ever felt wealthier than I did then, because most of my mates were poor students and I was doing the gap year thing. So I think the thing here is that, wealth is kind of subjective and we tend to compare to our peer group. And trust me when I say I've spent a number of years living in Southeast Asia in one of the world's poorest countries where the median income was like $1 a day. And yet loads of people there were happier with their journey. And yet by the other end of the spectrum, I've got a friend whose father was a billionaire, and I can guarantee you he's got just as many money problems as you or I. It's just different types of problems. And I think finally on that point, it's almost a cast iron law of life that all of us are going to face hardship and setbacks and challenges. And it's just a personal journey that we all go on. It's part of what makes us human and alive. So we'll try and keep the show as relevant as possible. And in that context, do send us in your questions for subjects you want us to cover, because I guess we always try to keep our finger on the pulse of what's happening. So, Chris, in that, with that sort of out of the way, three stories this week. So firstly, more information really on the housing supply, which seems to be the number one issue, I guess, in the housing market at the moment. Labour is miles off its proposed targets. Secondly, we're just going to look at the market cycles. Perth is the boom phase market at the moment, and some interesting stats there. And then thirdly, they've got a new book coming out next month with Kate Bakos. We co-authored one, The Buy Right Approach to Property Investing. Just want to talk a little bit about why we wrote the book and what we cover in it, because there's some interesting takeaways there. Apologies if you're watching on the video, that's the Aussie salute, just swiping the flies away this morning. So should we kick off with the housing supply figures then, Chris? So dwelling approvals, about 12,400 in February. That's pretty miserable stuff, 162,000 over the year. So that's the lowest in about 12 years. And even what gets approved in the current environment might not get built, because obviously developers are struggling.
Yeah, I really, you know, there's a lot of people attack the developers, and myself included, to be honest. If I look back on, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I could see some huge, huge issues in the offer plan sector. And I could see some major issues for people buying in greenfield land estates. I could see some major issues for people buying new townhouses. And, you know, and I was very against that, you know, I guess that type of investing. And I still am in to a certain extent. I think build quality is really upping its game. And I think that's part of the challenge here is that, you know, home buyers and investors, they want a quality product. You got to pay for it, right? We're not going and buying the cheap and cheerful investor apartments than the cheaper is better philosophy. People realize that doesn't work. And, you know, that's probably the only thing that's probably going to stack up potentially right now. And I have been a little bit negative. I do feel for the developers and the builders over the last 5 years. You know, if you look back on time, obviously COVID, but you had the material issues, the fixed price contract, you had weather, and then you've got a lot of them, they burnt all their liquidity, they built all their, you know, the builders going bust, people can't get finance right now, and you know, so they've got a lot of great builders who, and a lot of them bought work in COVID because they were worried about their work, you know, and they sort of shot themselves in the foot a little bit. So yeah, these numbers are pretty bad at a time when our population's off the charts, right? So those two things just don't add up. And we also are doing it in a when rents are rental crisis, and people are stuck in their homes now more than ever as well. So there's not even this turnover of stock, and there's this low stock on the market. And so it's kind of the worst time to have this, to be honest. And, you know, it takes – these are slow-moving, you know, big slow-moving whales, I guess. And, you know, even if, like Pete said there, even if you are getting approved, doesn't mean you're going to build it. You're still then going to have to go and market it and sell it, etc. And you know, you still have to make sure people can get finance when they can get off the ground. And so there is a lot of talk around this. I mean, I think Chris Minns is finally doing a once in a generation change to planning laws, and you know, that's getting a bit of pushback. I mean, I was reading an article literally this morning, I think it was, around the Woollahra Council in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, slapping heritage overlays on properties in the last 5 years because they saw this coming. And some of the properties that probably don't deserve heritage overlays and the locations probably should be more dense. And so that's really there's this fight between the councils. There's been a bit of an argument whether if councils can sort of push back the start date, if they say we've got a plan and we're working on a plan on how this is best in our council zone. So yeah, these conversations really going to kick off, and it's going to keep going, because as long as we don't build enough and we keep importing more people, and you know, just natural demographics, you know, the young single that meets a partner and then they want to move out and get a home and they want to have a family, like where are they going to buy, right? So there's just this natural demand that builds as people get older as well. And so yeah, it's not a pretty story, and the numbers are very dismal, and but it's getting a lot of media coverage, so I don't know what that's going to lead to, but I do think there's a lot of noise about it.
You're right. I think a few different points there. So on the previous cycle, look, there was an unprecedented shift to buyers from mainland China. So a lot of people were buying stuff out of a catalogue, sight unseen. Build quality was very questionable. And there was a lot of buyer's remorse there. I've spoken to people more recently who were caught up in all that, and they've lost a lot of money over 6 or 7 years. Now, the build quality has definitely improved. I think if you look at the latest building approvals figures, there's some bright spots there. Perth is booming back to life, particularly for houses. And it looks like houses in Melbourne have put in a bottom for the cycle. But if you look at units, apartments, townhouses, duplexes, in Sydney, Melbourne, and now even Brisbane, it's absolutely tanking for approvals. And I think it's just not really, things aren't really stacking up. And the same thing actually was evident in the housing finance figures. Lending for the construction and purchase of new homes, it's really around record lows. Even despite the population booming to around 27.2 million, it's still stuck around the levels we saw 15 years ago. I think, you mentioned there's a lot of construction insolvencies of late. We're around about the decade highs now. And from 1 July, actually, the unions are pushing for big pay rises across the sector. So developer margins are going to get squeezed even further in the second half of this year. I think to your point there about what's going to come as a result of this, because obviously there's an enormous issue here. Population growth of 660,000 and approvals of 12. You know, it's just it's a huge mismatch there. Even 160,000 over the year, you know, some of that will just replace what's already there, particularly in some of those sort of heritage overlay places like Woollahra and Manly. The stock just doesn't increase. Noosa is the same. But what's going to come as a result? I think, well, there's a lot of talk about build to rent. I think Labor is keen on it. Obviously, the super funds are keen on it. We've got offshore capital being raised. Big companies in places like Japan, America, Europe are interested in build to rent. In Australia, when you actually look at where that's going to take off, it seems to work in Melbourne in particular. So I think Melbourne will be the key point of focus, and to some degree Brisbane. When you actually look at the stats though, Sydney, it's not really working. And I understand the reason for that is that the land value per unit is just too high in Sydney to make it work. So the rental crisis is unresolved for now. It may be sort of tackled over the next few years by some build to rent towers. But there's other issues afoot as well. Land taxes in Melbourne are starting to kick in now, even for quite low-value properties now, with land values of 50K or more. Mm. And in southeast Queensland, Moreton Bay Council, the land valuation's up between 50 and 70%. So there's a lot of stuff there that's actually pulling in the other direction and making development or being a landlord just less attractive for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think one of the articles in the AFR was the Sydney exodus. You know, there was some data showing that it was particularly younger people, which have still got a lot of working life ahead of them. They can a lot of economic productivity they can add to the city if they start to leave, not just the cashed up downsizers. That's a real city with a problem. And I think Sydney is really, if it doesn't come up with solutions, it's going to get people leaving. And then secondly, you're not going to be able to attract talent from around the world. Because they're going to say, well, if I can't get a housing solution, how could I move there? And I think that'll start to move on to other cities and as they become unaffordable. I mean, Oxford Economics, they did an article in the AFR again today predicting some pretty big growth over the next, 3 years. I mean, I always take forecasts with a massive grain of salt. But what they're sort of showing is that there's, that supply-demand imbalance together with extra confidence with potential rate cuts and borrowing capacity increases, may actually just lead to a little mini boom. So what we thought was unaffordable today could actually get a lot more unaffordable, particularly if rates start to get cut. So that's not a bad thing for the building, though, because, once prices do go up, then the feasibility starts to make more sense, particularly if the council can come in, particularly if there can be some changes with, land tax or development taxes. And I think that's going to be a bit of pressure on the state government and the federal government to say, hey, how can we release more land or create more building? And what do we need to do? So before we maybe just encourage more demand, well, we haven't got a demand problem. What we have is a supply problem here. And we do have a demand problem to a certain extent because borrowing capacities are affecting buyers. Like they'd love to buy, they just can't borrow the money. So maybe there's some tweaks with lending. I'd absolutely see that happening. APRA stepping in, longer loans, you know, rate cuts, you know, et cetera. But maybe there's something else goes on around the taxes. You know, the budget's not long away, Pete. I can see housing affordability, rental market is going to be a major topic. And I wouldn't be surprised if some big policies start to get waved around.
Oh, I'm sure. I think actually there was a survey out by Roy Morgan this week that showed on a two-party preferred basis, for the first time, the government's now behind. Now, I think the way preference voting in Australia works, I've never really taken the time to understand it, but I would think with the preference voting, and there's a lot gone to things like other parties like the Greens and so on, I still think Labour is reasonably well placed. But nevertheless, with an election year coming up, yes, there'll be things like first home buy schemes and grants thrown around, maybe some pressure to cut the regulatory buffer from APRA. First home buyer numbers are actually up 20% from a year ago. I think that's really just a function of people trying to escape the really tight rental market. I think the Bank of Mum and Dad has kicked in there a lot. We've both seen plenty of examples of that with parents just trying to help their kids onto the housing ladder and get out of the rental market. But yes, first home buyers will be a key point of focus. I mean, Sydney always loses people interstate to some level. That's been happening for 40 plus years. But yeah, you need to make places accessible and affordable for aspirational migrants and for people who are living in Sydney already, because otherwise, you start to lose part of what makes it good. Other cities like San Francisco have struggled with similar issues in recent years, and to the benefit of places like Austin and Texas, you know. So definitely some challenges that will come into focus. And it feels like, yes, it feels like a cycle peak around 2026 or 2027. You know, a lot of people have talked about that. Well, it does kind of feel that way because it takes time to deliver medium density stock, probably 2 to 3 years. And actually, at today's prices, it just ain't working. So prices need to go up for a year probably before we start to see developers getting keen to get developments approved and built again. So yeah, look, as you said, it's a slow moving beast. It will be tackled over time, but at the moment, very, very tight rental market in particular. So Chris, that kind of feeds into our second story. Macro Business did a piece, Perth houses won't stay cheap for long. So I guess just looking around the stats at the moment, mining sector is booming again. Interstate migration to Western Australia has really taken off. Population growth over there is about 3.5% again, which is just like it was in the mining boom years. It's like back to the go-go years. Lots of reports of homes selling in Perth before the first open home. CoreLogic had prices up 20% over the year for Perth, well ahead of the 10% for the capital cities as a whole. What do you reckon in terms of, obviously, this is the boom phase of the cycle for WA. Do you think it's kind of too late, in inverted commas, there? Have you missed the bulk of the cycle, or is there still a way to go?
Look, I was just thinking about this because, I was reading that Oxford article this morning, and the Perth market was the strongest forecast and over the next few years. I mean, I remember, we got a mutual friend and client, Pete, right, that, I went to their wedding over in Margaret River. Many moons ago now. And I remember I got a tour with a buyer's agent there, a guy called Ray Tua. He's a buyer's agent there. We went around, we looked at the city. Where would be the places you'd want to buy right now? Counter-cyclical. Perth was, not seen as a hot market. And, and it was tempting. We were considering sending clients over there, and also, for myself, buying an investment property over there. But it was many years. You're only talking the last couple of years where Perth really kicked. And I reckon it was maybe 2015, 16 I was there. So, that's the issue, right? Like, it was prepped for growth, and a lot of people entered that market early. They would have bought over there, so they would have had this not getting the growth that they could have had in other parts of the city. And then all of a sudden, but someone has timed it over there and they bought in. I just wonder whether you're getting in a little bit late. I think growth usually happens in, spurts, right? There's a real repricing supply imbalance. It happens in investment markets as well. They chug on, quite high, and fast. And they can correct even faster, to be honest. That's sort of the saying, up the stairs, down the lift, but I do wonder whether it's just, but there is a crazy strong population growth over there, Pete, isn't there? I think it's, and you look back in time, it's a pretty, pretty big boom over there from the population, and that'll feed into a rental crisis. But the building industry had a huge oversupply problem. It was, there was huge incentives in the construction industry over there, particularly even in COVID. I think it was 55K or something you got towards a build, much higher than other states. And so, yeah, I wonder if you're a little bit late to the party and if the budget you've got over there, because budgets are tight from an investor's point of view, because borrowing capacity is really tight, whether that's going to force you into markets that are absolutely, you know, not the strongest markets. So A, you're buying in maybe a B or a C market, you know, not really where the locals, high income and wealth in the Perth want to live. And you went there for cash flow, but you've already, you know, those yields have started to drop because prices have gone up, and maybe there's more investors are going in there, and unless population increases keep going, what happens if you start to see a glut of rental properties in these suburbs? Yields start to, you know, rents start to drop or at least taper off, and then the growth starts to slow down as well. So
of course, yeah. I mean, I've got clients who owned through the previous cycle, and it was fantastic up until 2013 or so, and then yes, you've had really 10 years of nothing. And now another boom phase, and that's the nature of a cyclical market that's heavily resources dependent. I think just looking at the latest stats from CoreLogic and PropTrack, that one of the things they report is the median value of a dwelling. And of course, there's compositional impact because the median house in Hobart, for example, is going to be, or the median dwelling is just going to be a detached home, pretty close to the water, pretty close to the city. Adelaide, the same to some degree, whereas in Melbourne, there's many more apartments, townhouses, duplexes, and the median dwelling might be a house, but it might be quite a long way out from the CBD. So you're not really comparing like with like. But putting that to one side, if I was just taking a cold, dispassionate look at the numbers, you'd probably say Melbourne looked like the best value out of those cities. The median value of around 770K for Melbourne, slightly different on the PropTrack figures. They've got 800,000. But if you compare that to Sydney, it's considerably cheaper. It's actually below the median dwelling value for Brisbane now. Perth is probably around 700,000. But the way things are going, that gap's closing, like in the next few months, I guess. So I guess at the moment, Melbourne's had a few things pulling against it. There's been an anti-landlord sentiment. State debt levels have kind of spiraled. Land taxes are ripping higher. So there's a few things that have pushed Melbourne to be like a worst performer or one of the worst performers over the past year. But if you're thinking counter-cyclically, of course, I'm somewhat biased being Queensland-based, but I'd say Melbourne actually looks relatively much better value now than quite a lot of other parts of the country.
Yeah, I'm actually interviewing Jared McCabe this afternoon at 4 o'clock on The Elephant, and we're going to have a good chat about this exact topic, you know, because I actually do feel the same. I mean, Melbourne lost its mojo more than anywhere in Australia, right, in COVID. If you look at the stats, it's gone up about 17% since March 2020. A lot of other places around the country at 50, 60%. That's a big difference, you know, if you extrapolate that out over sort of the last 4 years. I think Melbourne is getting its mojo back. It's got this lot strongest population, you know, a lot of communities and cultures from all around the world. It's always been the strongest for, it's got a lot of, you know, industry, and it's a super city, right? It's 5 million. It's one of the best places in the world to live. It's always been up there with the awards. I think it's going to get its mojo back, right? I think their return to work's helping Melbourne, you know, that desire to get back to the office. I'm sure the CBD, I'm actually going down there in a couple of weeks for a bunch of meetings. And it's going to be interesting to see how the mojo is in the city. But I know, I think Melbourne's a good bet. I think particularly the housing market has been a little bit patchy, you know, because when COVID, people said, hang on a sec, I want space and I don't need to get to the city as much as I thought. And so the middle ring and the outer ring of Melbourne did actually quite well over the last 4 years, I reckon, when you look at the stats. But the inner ring maybe hasn't grown as much because people are willing to go a bit further than they used to in the past. Melbourne used to get pretty clogged up. I've lived down there in a few stints, and you know, that extra few kilometres could be quite a few more minutes in the morning, right? You know, a few of those roads used to get clogged up, and trains would get really busy, et cetera. And so people did prioritise close to the city as much as they could for that time saving and the certainty to get into the city for a certain time. You know, that stress of having to get to a meeting, if it's unpredictable, your route, then you try to get closer to the city. And so I do think that's where you're going to get that pressure cooker of Melbourne City is going to take off again. And I think in Melbourne, there was always a, look, I don't need to buy, I can always rent. Because rents and yields are always quite cheap in Melbourne. And there's always choice. Renting a house is always available. But I think slowly but surely, the more and more investors are pushed out of the housing market down there. That's going to create less houses for rent. You're going to start to see rental prices go up on houses. And then people are going to say, hang on a sec, why would I keep, it's harder and harder for me to rent a house. I need to buy a house. And I think you'll see this mini boom again in housing. I'm not as confident about units down there. Melbourne's got very relaxed planning controls. They can build units for fun. There's always new towers going up. And, you know, villa units are a bit different. Townhouses are a little bit different, especially if they're the older style townhouses, not the newer style. But, you know, just generally that sort of higher density stuff down in Melbourne, I would still be avoiding. But the housing market, I think, is a really good bet down there. And, you know, I'm a bit biased. I've got a house down there myself, so I probably should allude to that as well. I've got a bit of confirmation bias probably kicking in.
Oh, look, it is the biggest city in Australia now. I think it always depends with these things where you draw the boundaries and do you include the Central Coast. But actually, if you look at the population projections over the decades ahead, Melbourne will be the biggest city. Loads of demand for housing. Population growth's rampant at the moment. Biotech capital of Australia. There is an issue with state debt. But then again, New South Wales had something similar not so long ago, and they tackled that through asset sales and the world kept turning. I was down there for the grand final week last year. It was interesting. Yes, the Mojo thing. Well, the CBD, it absolutely pumping in the evenings and at the weekends. But during the week, still offices are still a little bit half empty and the office market is still correcting. The return to work has sort of happened and there's not that many people who are fully remote, but there's a lot of people who are just doing 2 or 3 days. That's what the stats seem to point towards is this hybrid model. And yeah, 17% capital growth over 4 years. It doesn't sound too bad, but in the context of construction costs that are up by more than 50, insurance costs are up 56%. So yes, in nominal terms, not too bad, but actually relative to the cost of building a house or the cost of or the inflation for things like eating out or insurance or any number of other things, not least rent, bit of an underperformer. I think, yes, the unit market, it's a bit like Brisbane. Was 3 or 4 years ago. It hasn't really done much for a decade. I think if you're buying family-friendly units or townhouses where you're buying under replacement cost and it's a tight rental market, you'll probably get a good spurt of growth at some point, I would think, just because of the sheer undersupply. But you've got to be very careful there because, as you said, this is where the tower blocks are going to come in, build-to-rent towers and so on, and you'll be competing with that part of the market. So I think if you buy... well, by the right type of property, right type of location. Yeah, I'd be pretty bullish on Melbourne myself, even though obviously being Queensland-based, I have my own biases. But yeah, just eyeballing the numbers, you know, the median values, you know, cities like Darwin are relatively cheap, but it just doesn't have the same fundamentals that Melbourne does from a demand perspective. So yeah, that would be my sort of brief take, Chris. So final story of the week and somewhat related. Got a new book coming out next month, a bit of a plug obviously, but the book I've co-authored with Kate Bakos, who you know very well, based down in Melbourne herself, The Buy Right Approach to Property Investing. We sort of realized we had a combined half a century of experience, so we figured we must have learned something good over that kind of time. And part of our thesis of the book really is that a few smart decisions in the property market can be genuinely life-changing, both for the better and for the worse, I suppose. Therefore, it really is important these days that the decisions you do make are taken well, because it's not really like the stock market where you can buy and sell very easily. It's very difficult to unpick bad decisions in the housing market sometimes. I think we sort of run through how everybody's different. We've got our own personalities, values and goals and ethics, and you need to make a plan that works for you, obviously. But a lot of the stuff we talk about resonates with what you preach, Chris, and that's the focus on quality over quantity, taking a longer-term vision, not interrupting compounding unnecessarily. And we use a lot of real-world case studies from Kate because she's in the market every day and she's seen a lot over the past 20 years in the real estate market as a buyer's agent. So there's lots of tips and traps and nuances that we go through. So keep an eye out for that one in the airport stores and the bookstores. It'll be out next month. Yeah, you've done some work with Kate yourself, I think, Chris, at some points over the years.
Yeah, Kate was the first buyer's agent I ever met, to be honest, back in 2012. Mm. I didn't know much about property, and hand in the air, I was like, I want to learn. I joined a business that fortunately had very good, strong property ethics. So it's a bit of a luck of the draw there, to be honest. I didn't know what I was joining up to. These guys sounded like they knew what they're talking about, but so does everyone in the property market. They referred me on to Kate. Kate was the buyer's agent in Melbourne. This is a business in Melbourne. I was the financial planner. I was doing meetings with mortgage brokers back then. Kate kindly took me out on the roads. I went out with her multiple times and, you know, just stood back and watched her at work. And Kate's probably the most active buyer's agents over the last decade in Australia. She is prolific, and she gets through a lot of clients and gets great results. We've had, you know, so many clients buy with Kate over the years. It's interesting you picked the buy right. I mean, you've written so many books, Pete, but, you know, those fundamentals are really what people should be focusing on, right? Like, you know, not trying to like arbitrage or, you know, get this, you know, hotspot or this return, right? It's about sort of trying to get a quality asset and hold it and hold it long-term and get the benefits of compounding and take your time and don't rush it. You know, that the decision between a good and a bad decision with the property will compound to a lot over the longer term. Is that sort of the you know, the premise of the whole book? Is that, or is there a lot more to it? Let me maybe give some more tips.
It definitely is. The subtitle is Mastering the Skills to Invest Wisely in Property. I think one of the things that you just alluded to there is that Kate is a highly driven personality type. And one of the things we go through a little bit at the outset is just talking through the various types of personality, because some people really love property, other people aren't really that interested, but obviously still need to make some big decisions in the housing market. I think it's really important to get onto the same page as your partner if you're buying jointly, because it's very unusual for both halves of a couple to be the same. You know, some people will be you know, much more emotional, other people be much more sort of thinker, analyzer personality types or risk averse. And I think it's worth doing some thought at the outset about what it is you're actually trying to achieve. How much is enough? How long are you going to be investing for? What is it? You know, what kind of passive income might you need in the retirement phase? I think because every personality type will have their own unique strengths, but also their own weaknesses. So as you mentioned, somebody like Kate, she wants to be the best in the industry, the best at what she does. She's like just a machine. She buys so many properties over the course of a year. So everything that you would ever want to know about Melbourne property, she would know. I guess the weakness or the potential risk for that personality type is actually finding the time to sometimes slow down and appreciate the journey. Now, I'm quite different to Kate, which makes it interesting that we managed to co-author our book together without falling out, because for my type of personality, I'm an optimist, which is good as that type of personality. But the risk for somebody like me is, yes, I'll take action, but the risk is getting distracted by the latest fads or whatever. Because, you know, when I look back on my journey, I've lived in Sydney and Darwin and Brisbane and then Noosa. I've spent some time overseas, always want to travel. So there's every person will have their own unique strengths, but there's also risks and weaknesses that you need to cover up as well. Because as you mentioned, you very often see the best results in the housing market are people who've bought well and just own property for the longest period of time. I've got friends who had parents who owned properties in places like Bronte, Wallara, Centennial Park, and the results over 50, 60 years have just been stunning. And yeah, there's a lot to be learned there from the success leaves clues things, I suppose. And if you look at the survivorship, even across the real estate industry, as you said, everyone sounds like they know what they're doing, but who are the people who've been around for 10, 20, 30 years, similar message, similar results, because the success there will leave some clues of their own.
Yeah, and sometimes people think, oh, you know, that what we're talking about is you have to buy in suburbs that are $2-4 million, or you have to buy in the most premium suburb. That's not true. The fundamentals will actually apply to all parts of a city, you know. So depending on your budget, you still need to apply the fundamentals. So you can't be like, well, I'm not able to get into the premium suburbs, so I'm not going to focus, make any effort to try to get the right property. No matter where you're buying in the country, no matter where, you should still be very careful in what you buy, because every suburb's got a better part and a worse part. Every, you know, there's better streets, there's worse streets, there's better sides of the street, there's bigger blocks, there's smaller blocks, there's weird floor plans, there's better floor plans, there's privacy issues, there's council-ish, you know, undesirable things in a suburb issues, there's, you know, real attractions in a suburb, there's close to transport, there's not close to transport. I could go on and on and on. But ultimately, you know, a suburb or a property is priced based on its livability and its lifestyle benefit, right? And if you can focus on those elements within that market that you're buying, yes, it might be more premium. So you might have to pay a more premium price within that suburb. But as a suburb gets more and more premium, that gap gets bigger. Because as the wealth gets a suburb, people start to pay more for the better properties. So that gap between the good stuff and the poor stuff in the cheaper suburbs is usually quite small, to be honest. And I think that's actually the best markets. Usually in the more expensive markets, the best stuff and the medium and average stuff, the gap's already grown to quite big numbers. And so sometimes it's really hard to get into the premium parts of suburbs because people already know that. They turn over less. They're willing to pay a lot more to be in that suburb. There's a lot more wealth. And there's a lot more income in those suburbs. And so then they go hammer and tong to get into that part of the suburb because they can afford it. And so the fundamentals apply across a country, and it actually applies internationally, to be honest. I think you can apply a lot of the things from Australia overseas once you understand them. Maybe not to the same extent because there's different ways that cities grow, but yeah, the fundamentals apply. So don't think this is an elitist thing that you have to be in certain suburbs. And I'm sure the book doesn't talk about that. Yeah, I look forward to reading it, Pete. How many books have you written now, mate? Are you up to double figures?
Oh, this is my seventh published book. Yeah, so it's interesting. I was talking to my colleague, Andrew Freed, who I work with, and he, like yourself, he bought a house in Perth, well, just a few years ago for him, good market timing. Then we were actually talking about Peter Kalizos, who left the testimonial for us in the book. And one of the things that Peter talks about is gentrification. So he's looked at places like Port Noarlunga and Adelaide. And I think this just circles back to what we were talking about right at the beginning. Everyone's on their own journey. And look, yeah, in the ideal world, we'd all own mansions at Vaucluse or Bellevue Hill or Dover Heights. But meanwhile, back in the real world, you have to work within the constraints that we have, things like borrowing capacity, what we can afford. And what Peter Kalizos has shown over the years is that over various periods of time, gentrification can be an enormous driver of growth. If you think about places like Newtown in Sydney, you couldn't even give homes away there. I mean, literally couldn't give them away some decades ago. The government almost had to pay people to take housing there. And now look at the prices in the inner west. Erskineville, the same. Western Sydney's had a big gentrification push in recent years. Woolloongabba in Brisbane or Kedron, which used to be really out of favour because of the tanneries in the industry. Now, phenomenally expensive. Geelong, Frankston, the list goes on. Plenty of options in Adelaide as well. So, yes, it's not all about buying the most expensive suburbs, the most premium areas. It's about finding the fundamentals. But also, yeah, if you can find a gentrification play where there's a big growth in two-income households, there's the sort of new amenities and cafes going in. We've seen something similar in places like Maruka in Brisbane over recent years. You know, it's gone from being very cheap to not so cheap. And so, yes, it almost goes back to what we were talking about right at the beginning, is that at various points in the journey, we'll only be able to do cheaper properties than we might want to, but it's about finding ways to keep moving forward within the bounds of those fundamentals that we talk about in the book. So, Chris, I think we're pretty much done for the week. So just to wrap up, housing supply issue is going to be front and center, I think, for the next year. We've got an election probably within the next 13 months or so. Plenty of contentious issues, I'm sure. I see the housing industry participants already pushing for things like first homeowners grants and so on. I'm sure that issue is not going to go away. The Perth market is closing the gap very quickly now on Melbourne and elsewhere, and I don't think they'll stay cheap for too much longer. And do keep an eye out. You can pre-order our new book, actually, from Major Street or from Amazon, The Buy Right Approach to Property Investing, Kate Bakos and myself. And I think that's about it for the week. What do you got planned over the weekend, Chris?
I'm actually heading up to Gold Coast. Actually, I've got a wedding for John in our team. He's getting married up in the hinterland there. So that's going to be pretty special. So, yeah, it's going to be good to explore in the the outskirts of Gold Coast. What about yourself?
Well, forecast looks good. Interestingly, because Gold Coast, actually, the median dwelling value I saw this week is now on a par or more expensive than Sydney, which you wouldn't have believed going back some years ago. But that just goes to show that even with some of the most, the least restrictive planning sort of settings in the country, because we always talk about Gold Coast is a place where you can build 300-metre towers. Well, that hasn't stopped prices catching up to Sydney. I think a lot of people have been drawn there over the past 4 years for the remote work. You've got water views, beaches and all that kind of thing. So I'd be interested to get your feedback, actually, on what you see happening at the Gold Coast, because it's been tremendously popular for the past 3 or 4 years. For me, pretty quiet one, I think. Just got the kids and might try and get out on the golf course. So finally got some good weather set for the Sunshine Coast. So you'll probably see me knocking around, hitting a few 7-irons most likely. So, but otherwise quiet.
Thanks, Pete. All right, happy Sunday to everyone. Thanks for listening. And absolutely send your questions through. Jump onto Pete's blog, jump in the show notes if you want to chat about broking. And we'll talk to you all next week. Happy Sunday.
Thanks for tuning into the Australian Property Podcast.
If you love the show, why not subscribe or leave us a review on Apple or Spotify?
And if you want to work with me, Amy, Pete or Chris,
you'll find links in your podcast player to get in contact with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Australian Property Podcast. We're huge advocates of getting the right advice at the right time from the right people. That's why it's important to understand that this podcast episode contained general financial information only. It is not designed to be specific or personalized to your financial, tax, or legal situation. With property, the check sizes are pretty big, so it's important you get advice from a licensed and trusted professional before acting on the information you hear in RASC podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called RASC Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. RASC Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. RASC Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the RASC Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.